This is an ABC podcast.
These days, the prospect of undergoing surgery is still a bit daunting, but you can be pretty sure you won't suffer through it. A highly trained anaesthetist will make sure that you'll go into a deep sleep, that you'll feel no pain, and that you won't even remember the experience. Of course, it wasn't always like this. Reading stories of pre-modern surgery, when operations were conducted without anaesthetics, where the doctor just had to cut away as swiftly as possible, well, that's enough to make your head swim. The science of modern anaesthetics is a truly wonderful thing. Christine Ball is an anaesthetist at the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne, and she teaches at Monash University, and she's also been a curator at the Geoffrey K. Museum of Anaesthetic History in Melbourne. Who knew there was such a place? And in that museum, Chris found an old casebook that inspired her to write a book on the life of one of the key figures and how we got from agony to peaceful slumber during surgery, which is surely one of the greatest things ever invented in the history of the world. This man's name was Joseph Clover, a deeply compassionate doctor working in Victorian London who treated the poor as well as princes and emperors. Chris's book is called The Chloroformist. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Richard.
You say in your book at the outset, just talking about the role of the anaesthetist, that patients who have operations generally remember their surgeon bearing the scars for the rest of their lives, but few remember their anaesthetist. And truly, that is the fact, isn't it? And it doesn't seem fair. And I wonder why this is. Do you think it might be because you, anaesthetists, you're all about making sure that things don't happen, like we don't get agonising pain, we don't wake up during surgery? Do you think that's what it is, or is it something else?
No, I think that's what it is. I mean, we do our best work while the patient's unconscious, so it's highly unlikely that they will remember us. But I think it is changing slightly in that we are now very involved in the whole patient perioperative journey. So patients are seen sometimes a long time before their operation in clinics, and we often see them afterwards as well as part of the post-operative ward round. So I think we are becoming more visible in the hospital.
Now, tell me, what does happen in the operating theatre? What's the relationship like during surgery between the surgeon or surgeons and the anaesthetist?
I think that's one of the things I like about anaesthesia is it's very much a team procedure, and it's not just the surgeon and the anaesthetist. There's a whole team of people, nurses, technicians, maybe instrument reps, medical students. All these people are in the room, and we have what we call a huddle at the start of the day, which is a very compassionate word, I guess, but we all get together and we talk about the list that's going ahead. We talk about who we all are. We introduce ourselves. We put our names on the whiteboard, even if we've worked together for years, and then we go through what the plan is for the day. So from that moment on, we're all working together as a team to improve the patient's journey and eventual outcome.
Do people talk when they're under?
No, they don't talk when they're under, no. But we do. We talk.
The reason I ask is I've said some incredibly strange things in my sleep, apparently, as has my wife. Do people say anything to you as they're going under? Do they say odd things to you?
People do say odd things as they're going under, and they say odd things as they're waking up and in recovery. But I can't share those things with you because one of the things we do promise our patients is confidentiality. Suffice to say, there are some very strange things that people say to you as they're going under, and I'm sure they would regret them later if they knew. But mostly, of course, they don't remember having said them. So,
now, here's the weird thing about the whole business of anaesthesia. When the patient goes under, do they still get pain, or does the fact that they're under make the whole concept of pain meaningless? Is there still pain when you can't feel it, I suppose, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, absolutely. So most anaesthetic agents are not analgesic. And so a proper anaesthetic or a good anaesthetic is what we call multimodal. It will involve something to make you unconscious. It will also involve probably several drugs to cope with the pain, because even though you are unconscious, you'll still have the physiological response to pain. So your blood pressure will go up, pulse rate will go up, you'll get sweaty, all of those things. So we want to avoid that. And also we want the patient to come around at the end of the operation free of pain. So we spend the duration of the surgery getting the pain under control so that ideally they wake up free of pain, and if not completely free of pain, then they spend half an hour to an hour in the recovery room where we ensure that they're totally free of pain before they leave and go back to the ward.
So the treatment of consciousness and the treatment of pain are separate things then?
They are, yes. Most of the drugs don't have analgesic properties. Some of them do, like nitrous oxide does have some analgesic properties, but they're gone as soon as the gas is excreted from your body. So we need something longer acting so that when the patient wakes up, they're actually free of pain for a considerable period of time. Now, of course, local anaesthetics are different. Local anaesthetics treat pain because they numb everything. And sometimes we add them into the mix as well. So we might have someone unconscious for the procedure, but have an epidural in that's going to stay in for several days after the operation.
Do you ever wonder where people go when they're under?
I keep an eye on them. I make sure they don't leave.
I mean, you know what I mean, though.
Yeah, I do know what you mean.
The persona, yeah, the person that was. I've had it once, a general anaesthetic once, and it's all about. I remember a dream coming out of it, but of course, I have absolutely no memory of that. I'd have no memory of going under, and I just wonder where I went all that time. Do you ever wonder that?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, I've been doing this for a very long time, and it never ceases to amaze me that. No matter how strong and combative the patient might be, eventually they will become unconscious on the end of the needle. And when we wake them up, they come back again. It's an extraordinary thing, anaesthesia. It really is. I mean, we're so lucky that it's possible.
Indeed. Do you know if we dream while we're under anaesthetic, or does the brainwave go flat or something?
No, the brainwave going flat's a bad thing. We don't want that.
Okay.
people do dream. What they remember is difficult to know. I mean, we can apparently hypnotise people and they will have different memories to what they might actually remember. I think there's some evidence that they dream, and certainly some drugs will make you dream. I mean, if we use things like ketamine for pain relief, and we do use ketamine as part of our anaesthetic regime, that can give people all sorts of strange hallucinations, but hopefully they're not aware of them because we give them other drugs as well. Most people just, the next thing they remember is us saying, it's all over.
I remember coming out of the anaesthetic and coming sort of surfacing into a bit of pain, and I said pain, I think, and then boom, I was out again. And I think they put me out. I don't even remember. But then I remember when I did come out of that second time, I felt great because all the opiates I'd been given were really, really working. And I went, and I, you know, of course, I'd survived surgery and I felt fantastic. And I think I sort of wanted to get up and around and they weren't going to let me do that. Is that common?
Yeah, I think people feel quite overwhelmed with having woken up and that they're all right. And often people are quite emotional when they wake up. And I find when people go to sleep crying, they tend to wake up from the experience crying and vice versa. You know, they really do seem like they come back to exactly where they were. If people are laughing as we render them unconscious, they often wake up laughing. And, yeah, there can be a real sense of euphoria that it's all over, plus the drugs, I suppose. I think reality hits a few hours later or sometimes a couple of days later when you realise you've got a lot to recover from.
So, Christine, tell me how you found the story of Joseph Clover. I mentioned there you stumbled on something in the Museum of Anesthesia, and like I said, who knew there was such a thing? Tell me the story of how you found this book that related to him in the museum.
So the JFK Museum is a really unique collection. We have one of the biggest collections in the world of anesthetic equipment, and the collection was started in the 1930s. And sometime in the 1930s, an anaesthetist in Britain gave this casebook to Geoffrey Kay, who was starting the museum. And then about 13, 14 years ago, we were doing an inventory of the collection, and we had just employed our first professional curator. So she was much more thorough than we had ever been, and she took all the picture frames apart and found this casebook. And it was just the most extraordinary mystery. We had no record of it. We had no idea why we had it. And so that started me on this journey of trying to find out, firstly, why we had this casebook, and secondly, what had happened to all his other papers and where were they? So I went on that journey. I didn't set out to write a book. I set out to solve a mystery, and it's turned into this book.
He was around at the same time as someone like Joseph Lister, who invented asepsis, you know, the idea of a completely antibacterial, antimicrobial space for surgery. Now, I've heard of Joseph Lister, but I've never heard of Joseph Clover, his contemporary there. Is he nonetheless a star in the, you know, secret society of anaesthetists, or part of the secret brotherhood and sisterhood of anaesthetists?
Well, he is. And so he's on the college crest in England, but no one has ever written his biography. And he doesn't fit into that Victorian great man narrative, which I quite like about him. You know, I'm a bit tired of the great men and even the great women of medicine. It's nice to find somebody who was just, he was a quiet enabler. You know, he was a collaborator. He wasn't somebody who sought out the limelight. He was someone who allowed other people to do their work and really facilitated a lot of really good work by other people. And I think that's one of his most endearing qualities in my eyes. And I think that's what anaesthetists do in many ways. We are collaborators and we enable good work by other people.
His life encompasses that era where modern surgery goes from leather straps and maybe giving the patient plenty of rum and something to bit between their teeth to a situation which is much more recognisably like the one we live in today, which arrived by the end of the 19th century. Well, tell me a bit about him, the kind of family he was born into. Was he posh or upper class?
No, not at all. So he came from a place called Aylsham, which is a little village just out of Norwich. It's a really pretty, beautiful little village. And his father ran the general store there. And his mother inherited money when he was about 10 years old. I think their lives improved considerably at that time, although they did keep the shop and seemed to have leased it out. So I think they were sort of, they were tradesmen, they were artistic. They didn't come from the nobility or the upper class in any way.
He had tuberculosis in his youth and was often sick throughout his life. I wonder if you think this made him quite a compassionate man towards his fellow pain sufferers, if you like.
It's very hard to know that, isn't it, whether the disease makes the man or... So he definitely was very unwell right from the time he was an apprentice. And he does seem to have been very compassionate, but it's really impossible to know which came first. I think the family itself seems to have been quite a caring family. They were all very close. It's probably a bit of both. I'm sure being chronically unwell does make you more compassionate, or it could just make you angry, I guess.
He began as an apprentice to some local doctors. Mm-hmm. What kind of surgical work did he help them with? What kind of work were they doing on patients back in those days in the 1840s?
Well, that's the fascinating thing about his papers once I started looking for them, because, you know, we don't talk a lot about the sort of surgery that was done before anaesthesia. We talk about amputations because they're horrific and, you know, they capture the imagination, but we don't talk about things like cleft palate repairs and lumps and bumps that had to be removed, and bladder stones in particular, which were a big problem in the Norfolk area. There seems to have been a real endemic of bladder stones up there, and that was not a minor operation. They didn't have, at that stage, when he was an apprentice, any tools for getting into the bladder through the urethra. So they had to cut into the bladder to remove these bladder stones. And that is a horrific thing to contemplate, really.
Now, you medicos have got pretty strong stomachs. and modern medicine can be a bit, to use the technical term, a bit yucky at times.
Yep.
But if modern medicine is a bit yucky, Victorian-era medicine seems to be... have been about five times as yucky. Everything's like ulcerated. There are giant tumours. There are some great wasting STDs. And
yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You frighten children with that, and quite a few grown adults as well.
I think that's right. And so I guess that's what the apprenticeship was all about. I mean, you know, medical students now spend quite a bit of time at the university before they get anywhere near a patient, whereas these doctors... they learnt their trade as apprentices. So I guess if they were squeamish, they got over it pretty quickly or they left.
There's a story of a tonsillectomy that he attended where a young girl had to be tightly strapped down and then the surgeon just got to act really quickly. Was that the thing that really characterised surgery in those early days? The surgeons just had to, without anaesthetic, they'd have to operate so quickly.
Well, I think that's one thing. I think some operations were performed really quickly, but other operations, I think, were surprisingly slow. And that was something that really surprised me when I was going through his casebooks. He described operations taking over an hour. And I think what happened in those situations was they were relying a lot on the cooperation of the patient. So unlike the quick sort of surgical removal of a leg, where obviously that's horrific and they tie you down, they cut your leg off and you pass out, I think some of these operations, they were very slow. So the bladder stones, you know, they would make the incision, they'd wait for the patient to get their composure back, they'd probe around, try and find the stone. If they didn't find it, they'd wait a bit, let the patient get better. And there's a lot of descriptions of that in his notes and some other people's notes, that they really relied on the patients to cooperate with the patients, which is hard to imagine, but I guess, you know, that's how it had to work.
I know someone who had a bladder stone, and she said it was worse, it was more painful than childbirth, having a bladder stone. It was so awfully, hideously painful. Did they have to have them treated despite the pain? I mean, if you didn't treat it, was it likely to kill you in the end?
I think they were huge, these bladder stones. They would grow to enormous proportions. And the stories that you read about the King of the Belgians, who by the time he was operated on, this was some years later and they did have anaesthesia, but he was unable to sit or lie down and had been basically standing up for about 3 weeks. Now, that's not sustainable. He was sleeping standing up, held by his servants. That's how bad they were. So I can see that people would ultimately want them removed no matter how bad they were. Plus, you know, they got infected bladders as a result, so they would get quite septic and sick.
So how did they treat it then before there was anaesthesia? I mean, would they have to open up the abdomen?
No, they went in through the perineum, you know, so they would put the patient's legs up, press their knees up against their chest and get someone to hold their knees up, and they would cut in behind the bladder through the perineum, and then they would probe with instruments to find the stones. And that's why the instruments we use today to get into the bladder are called sounds, because they were looking for the sound of the tapping on the stone. I mean, obviously now we can see into bladders with endoscopes, but they were relying on actually tapping the stone and hearing it because they couldn't see it.
With what? With like a scalpel or a needle or what?
Like a big metal probe. Disgusting, horrible, great big metal. So they'd make an incision with a scalpel, and then they would put the sound in, and then they would put forceps in. Like, yeah, it's horrific. And they were relying on also the patient telling them, apparently once they got into the bladder, if they grabbed the stone, it wouldn't hurt too much, but if they grabbed the lining of the bladder, then that would be really painful and the patient would have even more excruciating pain, so they would know that they had the wrong thing. And that was why for many years, despite anaesthesia, the surgeons kept going with a lot of bladder surgery without anaesthesia, because they were worried they would damage the bladder if the patients couldn't tell them what they were doing.
Apparently, a lot of the time patients had to be strapped down. Was there a risk that if you didn't strap down the patient, apart from them thrashing about in agony, they might just leap off the table and run away?
Yeah, there definitely was a risk. And it did happen, I think. And so there were surgeons who made a point of getting consent from the patient to restrain them and said to them, once the operation's started, no matter how much you protest, we are going to finish it because it'll be too dangerous not to. So I need your consent to restrain you despite what you ask after this moment.
So meanwhile, in the United States, there was the first public demonstration of anaesthesia with this anaesthetic that they called ether. What was ether? What was this early anaesthetic?
It's a very simple compound, ether, and it was very freely available. It was being used as an inhalational agent for, you know, things like asthma, I suppose, and it's a solvent, so it's used for cleaning as well. So there was a lot of ether around, and ether was being used as a recreational drug.
It sounds pleasant, but was it pleasant?
I've never inhaled it as a recreational drug, I have to say, but it smells disgusting. I mean, I have smelt it, and so many older people remember that smell. It's what hospitals really smelt of in the 50s and 60s. They used it so much, not just for anaesthesia, but for cleaning, and it's a very recognisable smell, but it's also flammable.
Like ammonia, or is it sulfuric, or what?
It is a bit like ammonia. It's not a very nice smell, but it's flammable and it's a drug. It's a scheduled drug, so we're not allowed to keep it in the museum. But if people were just looking to get a bit silly and high, then medical students and some of their friends would have parties. They were having ether frolics. So it can't have been that unpleasant.
If it was known to have been a painkiller for centuries or something that could knock you out, why did it take so long for people to make the connection between using ether for surgery?
It's hard to answer that question. I mean, Humphrey Davy was the first to suggest, he suggested nitrous oxide about 45 years before he had anaesthesia. He suggested it might be used to alleviate the pain of surgery. But I think the concept of actually administering those drugs like nitrous oxide or ether to somebody else to the point of unconsciousness was probably just a step too far. I think someone inhaling it themselves just to get a bit giggly was probably more worrying. It made the surgeons think the patients might get difficult to handle and uncooperative. And they didn't want uncooperative patients. They wanted cooperative patients. So,
well, one of the reasons why I ask is because I did speak years ago to a pain specialist, a very eminent pain specialist, who said there was a theory that was hung on to for a very long while, well into the modern era, that pain was a part of the recovery process. I wonder if that thinking that pain was actually good for you might have fed into that reluctance.
Oh, definitely. I mean, there are some statements by very eminent surgeons, you know, two or three years before anaesthesia, where they were actually saying, we will never have anaesthesia. Pain is an integral part of this. Pain's important for healing. And, you know, it's sort of understandable that they believe that. They believe the same thing about the pain of childbirth, that if you were to alleviate the pain of childbirth, then something would go wrong with the child or the mother. But I think we got over that pretty quickly.
There was a moment when Joseph Clover, when he started to study for his degree, if that's the word for it, at University College London, he observed the famous Robert Liston perform surgery, an amputation on a man who had a gangrenous leg. What effect did it have for people like Clover and Joseph Lister to observe an operation as ghastly as that on a patient who was knocked out successfully by ether?
It's hard to know because there are very few first-hand accounts of that day, but he was definitely there, and he spoke about it later. And Joseph Lister was there, not actually as a medical student at that stage. I think he was still studying arts at that point, but he knew somebody and managed to get into the room. So we don't know exactly what all those young men were thinking, but they must have been completely amazed by it. It must have been an extraordinary moment. And certainly Robert Liston was completely overwhelmed, and he was a real pusher of anaesthesia in the next few weeks and months.
In Paris, Joseph Clover saw a French surgeon named Jean Civial perform surgery to remove one of these hideously painful bladder stones. And this man was a pioneer of minimally invasive surgery. Tell me about what he saw there, the technique that was used by Jean Civial to treat these evil bladder stones.
So what Civial used was instruments through the urethra. So then no incision is required. You can just, now it's not comfortable, obviously, to have a large probe inserted through your urethra to grasp a bladder stone, but it's much more comfortable than having an incision made behind your urethra into your bladder. And it also decreased the risk of infection and bleeding. And so that was really game changing. And the other thing that Sevier was recognised for was somebody who really did some really qualitative, quantitative research and collected really good data on what he was doing. He didn't just start doing something new. He started collecting statistics, which was also fairly new at that time. So he was a real game changer. And we still, that's how we do a lot of bladder surgery now, is through the urethra. But we do it with cameras, and we project the images up onto huge TV screens. So we're not grasping for things in the dark anymore.
So the scientific method is increasingly being used to enormously good effect here through the mid-19th century, and patients are being sometimes given ether to knock them out to experience, ideally, some form of pain-free surgery. What were the problems that they found at that point in using ether as an anaesthetic?
But ether's not a great anaesthetic. I mean, it renders people unconscious, so that's good, but it smells bad and a lot of people find it quite suffocating. It causes quite a bit of agitation in the first few minutes as people are becoming unconscious. It causes a lot of nausea and vomiting. And so there was a search pretty quickly to find something else. Once they realised that anaesthesia was possible, they went looking for another agent. And within about 12 months, chloroform was discovered. And pretty quickly, chloroform, especially in London, really overtook ether as the main anaesthetic. And that's a much more pleasant drug to inhale, I gather. I've never inhaled chloroform. But the problem with chloroform is that it was causing random deaths, inexplicable deaths. And that did become a problem for many, many years.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
So, Chris, we were talking before about the use of ether and the problems with ether, and then chloroform arrived. Why did that at first seem to be so much better than ether as an anaesthetic?
Chloroform works very quickly. It seems to be very pleasant to inhale, and you don't need very much of it. So given that most operations were not happening in hospitals in those days, most operations took place in people's homes or even in hotels, doctors had to carry their anaesthetic agents with them. So chloroform was very portable, and you only need a very little bottle of it to give quite a considerable amount of anaesthesia.
Now, I love the story you've got in your book of what happened when an Edinburgh doctor named James Simpson decided to play around with a bottle of chloroform, and how this kind of led to its use as an anaesthetic during surgery. Tell me what happened when he decided to muck around with a bottle of chloroform with him and his assistants.
So James Simpson was an obstetrician, and he was the first person to use ether, which was the first anaesthetic, as pain relief in labour. But women, although they wanted pain relief in labour, didn't love ether for all the reasons we discussed. So he was looking for a better agent, particularly for labour pains. And he had some friends in various chemists' shops, and he was getting a lot of advice from various people about the various chemicals that might work. So he had a series of dinner parties over that year, and I think they would have dinner first, which is not advised before you start trying out volatile substances. And on this particular occasion, they had dinner. There were a number of them there. And as they normally did, the women went off after dinner to, you know, do whatever they did, have coffee somewhere else, and left the men to their experiments. And the men all inhaled chloroform, and it got very quiet in the dining room. The women got quite concerned and came back in to find Simpson and all his mates lying on the floor, unconscious. And they were quite adventurous women, because once the men came around, they all wanted to try it too. So they were at it till about 3 a.m, apparently, when they ran out of chloroform. And he very quickly took the chloroform and tried it on patients. So there were no sort of there was no FDA or drug approval right. process to go through. You just put it in your bag and went off and found a patient to try it on.
And how did they administer it in those early days?
They administer it very simply, just on a cloth, a piece of lint, dripped some chloroform onto it and put it over the patient's face and got them to breathe through it.
You mentioned there were some early deaths in the use of chloroform. What was it that was killing people about the chloroform?
Well, of course, they didn't know what was killing them about the chloroform. And in retrospect, it's hard to know exactly what every single patient died from. We found out in the 1920s that chloroform causes atrial fibrillation, which is a condition where the heart doesn't really beat. It just sort of wobbles around and doesn't beat properly. So chloroform predisposes you to ventricular fibrillation. And it's likely that a lot of these patients died from ventricular fibrillation, but many of them may have died from other things. They may have died from simple drug overdose. They may have been asphyxiated. They may have vomited and aspirated. We just don't really know, but we do know that it was causing quite a lot of problems.
So there might be two factors at work here. One is they may have a pre-existing heart condition. And the second thing then is really about the quantity of chloroform that's being administered then.
That's true. And that was what Clover really worked out, was that firstly, John Snow, who was one of the very first anaesthetists in London and famously gave chloroform to Queen Victoria, he worked out the right dose in order to render someone unconscious and also keep them safe. And he never actually managed to design a piece of equipment that could do that in an operating theatre. He only did it in his sort of laboratory, whereas Clover developed this equipment which allowed you to deliver a known concentration of chloroform. So the first calibrated vaporizer, we would call it.
Meanwhile, the Crimean War broke out in what is now modern-day Ukraine, and Britain was involved as along with Russia and I think the Ottoman Empire as well. Tell me how that war in the Crimea was able to advance the practice of surgery.
The Crimean War was a very messy war by all accounts, and there were a lot of surgery needed to be done, and they did use chloroform in the field of war. Now, prior to that, they had decided that some wounds were not treatable. You know, if you'd been stabbed through into the abdomen, they would expect you to die because you would have an infection, you know, if you'd got bullet wounds or whatever. So they would actually probably just leave those people to die. But with chloroform, they had other opportunities. And Spencer Wells, who was one of the surgeons who was down there, was just a young doctor at the time, he did realise that once people were under chloroform, they had more time and the surgeons were able to clean some of these abdominal wounds that obviously weren't quite as bad as, you know, they obviously hadn't penetrated too much bowel or anything really catastrophic, but they would clean out the peritoneum and the patients would actually survive. And that was quite a surprise, but that was something he took back to London when he returned there and started to be a bit more adventurous with his surgery as a result, because he realised that maybe the peritoneum and the intra-abdominal cavity wasn't quite as dangerous a place as they had believed if you were clean about what you were doing.
So this is the other great gift of anaesthetic then. One is, the release from pain for the patient, but the second is the gift of time.
That's right.
This is what gives them the chance to actually conduct operations where they don't have to hack and slash as quickly as possible to reduce the misery of the patient. This is where they can actually spend time, study the wound, extract what needs to be extracted, and then attempt more complicated surgery as a result of this then.
Yeah, and definitely. And then what happened back in London, you know, some of these people who had horrendous wounds got back to London and had what we would regard, I suppose, as experimental surgery. So rather than amputating their leg for a wound to their knee, there were surgeons who would remove just the knee joint. Now, obviously, their leg would get a lot shorter as a result, but, you know, they'd build up shoes and get them walking again. So there was a lot of more conservative surgery, we would call it limb-conserving surgery, things that they'd never been able to do before because the patients wouldn't have been able to tolerate it.
There seems to be a story of where developments all sort of work hand in hand, like anaesthetic advances, the whole quality and sophistication of surgery. And meanwhile, then you have Florence Nightingale in the Crimean War. How did she contribute to the advancement of surgery at that time?
Florence Nightingale was a real public health advocate, and she went out to the Crimea and also promoted cleanliness and just, you know, clean dressings, good food, proper nursing care. They built a prefabricated hospital there, and that was completely redesigned with the help of a doctor from University College Hospital, Edmund Parks, and Florence Nightingale. They all consulted about the things that were important: clean airflow, clean bedding, toilets separated away from the hospital wards themselves, and all of those things, I think, played out in the Crimea and then were then taken back to London and to other major capital cities in England.
Mm. It seems to be the time when we start to see nurses being referred to as like angels in a way, like the reverence for the nurse seems to appear at this time as well.
I think nursing was badly done by history. I mean, nursing staff prior to all of this were certainly there and they were looking after patients, but they were often sort of badly treated by the institutions. You know, they were not given the resources they needed, and it took somebody like Florence Nightingale, who'd actually been properly trained as a nurse and who was quite strong-minded, I think, to stand up for what was required. She really did change what nursing staff were given in terms of resources and training, which was not there before.
One of the great things about Joseph Clover, your hero at this time, is that he starts to invent all these devices, these kind of devices, and I've seen drawings of them. And this is, of course, at a time when there's no plastic. So people, they're using rubber and copper and glass and silk and all sorts of other substances like that. Tell me about some of these devices he developed at that time.
So the vaporizer we were talking about before is pictured on the cover of the book, and it's the most remarkable piece of equipment. I mean, it was so ingenious because what he had to do was measure out a known amount of chloroform, put it into something where it would vaporize quickly, so he needed a heated chamber, and then inject a known amount of air over that chamber so that he got the right concentration of chloroform. And then he put it all into this great big bag which he slung over his shoulder. It was a huge bag, huge great thing, and held litres and litres of chloroform-laden air. And then he would sort of cap that off and go to the patient and open up the valve and give it to them. But what was remarkable, he must have had help from various instrument makers because he couldn't have made a lot of that stuff in his own basement where he did a lot of his experiments. And the instrument makers of those times, I think, were very cooperative. And then those photographs, the photograph that's on the cover, and there's another one inside the book, were taken for the 1862 International Exhibition, which is something I found really fascinating because I had no idea that they were using those international exhibitions as sort of trade fairs for medical equipment.
It seems like the point of these devices was to administer successfully so much chloroform to work on the patient, but no more than that. How successful were these devices in putting the patients under and not killing them?
Well, I think, you know, Clover had an extraordinary track record because he gave something like 15,000 anaesthetics before he actually had a death from chloroform, which is
15,000.
Yeah, extraordinary track record. You know, he just had 20 years without a death.
And even by modern standards, is that pretty amazing?
Well, I think, you know, the death rate from anaesthesia now is quoted at about 1 in 80,000, so probably not.
But still bad, eh?
Yeah, no, not bad. And I think, you know, that's the other thing about him. He obviously kept meticulous records. He wrote up every death that he had under anaesthesia.
Now, before you get an operation that's not an emergency operation these days, the anaesthetist will by and large come by your bed a few days beforehand and have a chat with you and reassure you and tell you exactly what's going to happen and ask if there's anything he or she can do to help. Was he like that? Did he do that with his patients?
Yeah, he definitely did. And so when they were planning really big operations, they would all get together and plan just like we would today. So there's a great case in the book that I really love. This man had this huge, great big jaw tumour which extended right down over his chest. It's quite horrific. This man could barely open his mouth and was really wasted away from not being able to eat. And the tumour was something like 19 inches long.
Wow.
And they planned this operation meticulously and they brought the man into hospital. You know, they made him as fit as they could. They gave him beef tea and raw eggs. And then they planned the whole operation, who was going to do what. It was a real military exercise. And it's so like what we would do today. We would plan a big operation like that today in much the same way.
Did the poor man survive that?
He survived for about 5 days and then he died of sepsis. And that's really sad because it was really a year or two before Lister worked out his carbolic acid spray. And if they had, just a couple of years later, he might have survived. They did use some disinfectant. They used a thing called Condy's fluid. But they were just a couple of years too late. But he did survive and he was eating and drinking and writing on a slate board. So the operation itself was extraordinarily successful.
Well, then nitrous oxide came into use as an anaesthetic, laughing gas. What were nitrous oxide's strengths and weaknesses as an anaesthetic?
So nitrous oxide is a gas, and chloroform and ether are what we call vapors. So you just need a little small bottle of ether or chloroform to anaesthetize someone. But nitrous oxide you need a lot of gas. So the storage and making of the gas is complicated. Now, they knew how to do that, and nitrous oxide, once again, had been used as a drug of recreation. It was being used in fairgrounds in America before we had ether anesthesia, and they would make it in these big sort of stills, and then they would put it into these sort of bladders, and they'd get people to inhale it on the stage, and they'd fall about laughing, and because it really does make you laugh, and it was all very entertaining. And then gradually they realised that it had anaesthetic properties, and it was reintroduced as an anaesthetic in England in the 1860s, by which stage, of course, people were used to anaesthesia and the concept of it. And it was the dentists that first introduced it, and it has some analgesic properties. We were talking before about anaesthetics not having pain-relieving properties, but nitrous oxide does. So it's quite useful as a dental anaesthetic. You don't need to be fully unconscious. It will just help with the pain.
Yeah, but surgery, I mean, that's something else, isn't it? Like, because you've got to keep sucking on it, don't you? Because you come down pretty quickly from nitrous oxide.
Yeah, so that was a disadvantage. And you can't really give a full general anaesthetic with nitrous oxide. You can't give enough of it. You need to give 100% nitrous oxide. And there were certainly people that did that, but then your anaesthetic is not just the nitrous oxide, it's asphyxia. And that's not recommended for longer than a couple of minutes, really. So they had to come up with better solutions. And that was another thing that Clover really excelled in. He used his big bag that he developed for chloroform to hold nitrous oxide. And then he also later worked out that you could combine nitrous oxide and ether. And that's when we really get the foundations of the anaesthetic machine we have today, because that's pretty much, although we have this huge, great machine now that looks like something out of the flight deck of a 747, we're pretty much just giving gas and vapour together like he imagined in the 1870s.
1872. Clover was called to attend the French Emperor in exile, Louis Napoleon, the nephew of the great Napoleon I. What was Louis Napoleon suffering from when he went to attend him?
So he had bladder stones as well, and that may have had a role in his loss during the revolutions, but because he had had them for quite a long time and had been in a lot of pain. But anyway, he was in exile in London, or Chislehurst, just out of London, and he had these bladder stones which were causing him considerable problem, and he was getting quite septic from them. And Henry Thompson, who at that stage was one of the leading experts in bladder stone surgery in England, was called to treat him, and he worked with Clover regularly. So they caught the train. There's just some wonderful letters in Clover's papers where Henry Thompson wrote him a note saying, "Dear Clover, please be at the 2:15 train at Charing Cross to go with me to treat the Emperor. We'll be back at 5. but they weren't at, well, I think they'd come back the first day, but they went back and ended up staying there for quite a few days because he needed quite a lot of operations.
So the poor man was given chloroform, and it seemed to go well. What went wrong with the operation in the end?
Well, I think he had a number of bladder stones. They couldn't get them all out, and he got increasingly septic and was really dying of sepsis. And fortunately for Clover, on the last day, they had decided they were going to operate, and Clover went to see him, and being a good perioperative physician, he examined him and said he wasn't fit for anaesthesia, but that they should wait and reconsider later in the day. And then about an hour later, he died. So Clover was very fortunate that he had made that assessment and not gone ahead with the chloroform, because he almost certainly would have died under the anaesthetic, which wouldn't have been great for anybody.
Well, there were plenty of conspiracy theories going around about the death of his predecessor, his uncle Napoleon I, who died of poison, or seemingly, in St. Helena, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Were there conspiracy theories about the death of his nephew, Louis Napoleon?
Oh, definitely. And there were definitely French sympathisers who thought that the British surgeons had killed him. There was a lot of bad press, when a lot of conspiracy theories. Nothing was very different in the 1870s to now. There were lots of conspiracy theories and bad press about it. Well, there's still articles written now about whether he was killed by the surgeons, but I think the overwhelming evidence is that he died of sepsis and that they made a good decision not to do that last operation.
He lost a few patients, Clover did, on by administering chloroform for various reasons, as you laid out there. So we went back, as you say, to working with ether, this time mixed with nitrous oxide. Why was that such a good idea, the mix of the two?
Well, the mix of the two allows you to control the dose more carefully of the ether, but also to allow you to put the patient off to sleep with the nitrous oxide rather than the ether, because patients didn't like the smell of ether, whereas nitrous oxide is quite pleasant to inhale. So what Clover would do is give them nitrous oxide to start with, and then as they got used to the nitrous oxide and started to lose consciousness, he would gradually introduce the ether into the mix until it got to the point where he could give more ether and less nitrous oxide.
So you're saying essentially the nitrous oxide anaesthetised them to the point where they could accept the ether, and then that in turn anaesthetised them to the point where they could have the surgery, essentially.
Yeah, and we still do that today. We don't use a lot of nitrous oxide today, but some patients really can't tolerate injections, or we can't get into a vein, or for whatever reason they want what we call a gas induction, and we will often use nitrous oxide in air or oxygen to start off that induction and gradually introduce the vapor. And we can do it without nitrous oxide, but we still have nitrous oxide available if we need it, and that's still a technique that is quite helpful in certain situations.
Now, it seems that beards were almost compulsory. Hipster beards were compulsory amongst men in the Victorian era. Did that present a problem for creating the kind of face masks that you needed to strap to someone's face in order to anaesthetise them?
It did, and it still does. So,
really?
Yeah, beards are a problem, and so because you can't get a good seal, even with a modern, really well-cushioned mask, you won't get a good seal with them.
So do you need to ask people to shave before they go in for an operation?
Sometimes we do, and it depends.
Do they bitch and moan?
Yeah, they bitch and moan. And, it's not just beards. I mean, I have issues with tongue piercings and other things that are going to get in our way. They didn't have that problem in the 1800s. But beards can be problematic, and if we think we're going to have any problem actually ventilating the patient, then we will ask them to shave their beards off. And otherwise, sometimes we can put like Vaseline all over them to sort of flatten out the beard so that it's less hairy. Beards are a problem.
So how did poor old Joseph Clover, after doing all this good work, how did he meet his end?
Well, he died in his 50s, which is quite remarkable that he lived as long as he did, because he was quite sick through his whole life. He died probably of tuberculosis that I think by that stage had infected his kidneys, and he became uremic, so he developed renal failure. He was very sick for about a year, and that's a long time to wait to die. I think it was a bit sad.
That was nearly like 30, 40 years since he'd started out as an apprentice.
Mm.
And you think of the achievement through those four decades in the middle of the 19th century, where you go from agony to anaesthetic, surgery that's just like to something that's actually much more sophisticated. You have much cleaner surgical theatres and all of that. By the time he died, was there a growing sense of achievement around all of this? Like there's something really massive has happened here.
There definitely was. And so 1881, there was a big international congress, and that was a new thing too. So prior to when Clover was an apprentice, there were no international medical meetings, and that was something that developed during that time as well. So the 7th International Medical Congress was held in 1881, just a few months before he died. And the opening surgical address, they actually said that look what's happened in the last 35 years. We've got anaesthesia and we've got antiseptics. And I think there's the wonderful line that I can't quote exactly, but in the past, the surgeon just sowed seed into a fertile field and to see what would grow there, you know, in terms of infection. And now we're expected to be much more precise about what we do, and we don't anticipate infection. We can be much more precise and we can do much better surgery. So they were really celebrating it at that time. It was seen as a real milestone. There were still people that didn't believe in microorganisms and antiseptics, but pretty close.
Really, there were microorganism skeptics out there, were there?
Well, yeah, you'd be surprised. there definitely were.
Right. Okay. I don't know, you've spent the last few years living alongside, if you like, Joseph Clover, this 19th century doctor, with his letters, his correspondence, his notes, all of that sort of thing. What do you like about him, having spent all that time with him, so to speak?
I really admire him for his clinical skills and his perseverance, but I also really appreciate his compassionate nature and his kindliness. I think there's no doubt he was a very kind man, and that's not something we tend to talk about much in Victorian England. We think about Victorian medicine as being quite brutal, but he was a very compassionate, very kind man, and I think there were a lot of people around him who were also like that, and I think that's something we should talk about more, people who were kind and compassionate in those times.
It's so lovely to speak with you. What a remarkable story and the tale of someone we owe a great deal of gratitude to. Thank you so much, Chris.
You're very welcome, Richard. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.